Out of the Silent Planet, continued. Ransom found it impossible to get down from the wall. He remained sitting there, not frightened, but rather uncomfortable, because his right leg, which was on the outside, felt so dark, and his left leg felt so light. "My leg will drop off if it gets much darker," he said. Then he looked down into the darkness and asked, "Who are you?" And the queer people must still have been there, for they all replied, "Who, who, who," just like owls. He began to realize that his leg was not so much dark as cold and stiff, because he had been resting the other on it for so long, and also that he was in an armchair in a lighted room. A conversation was going on near him, and had, he now realized, been going on for some time. His head was comparatively clear. He realized that he had been drugged or hypnotized, or both, and he felt that some control over his own body was returning to him, though he was still very weak. He listened intently without trying to move. "I'm getting a little tired of this, Weston," Devine was saying, "and especially as it's my money that is being risked. I tell you he'll do quite as well as the boy, and in some ways better. Only he'll be coming round very soon now, and we must get him on board at once. We ought to have done it an hour ago." "The boy was ideal," said Weston sulkily. "Incapable of serving humanity, and only too likely to propagate idiocy. He was the sort of boy who, in a civilized community, would be automatically handed over to a state laboratory for experimental purposes." "I dare say, but in England he's the sort of boy in whom Scotland Yard might conceivably feel an interest. This busybody, on the other hand, will not be missed for months, and even then no one will know where he was when he disappeared. He came alone, he left no address, he has no family, and finally he has poked his nose into the whole affair of his own accord." "Well, I confess I don't like it. He is, after all, human. The boy was really almost a preparation. Still, he's only an individual, and probably quite a useless one. We're risking our own lives, too, in a great cause. For the Lord's sake, don't start all that stuff now. We haven't time." "I dare say," replied Weston, "he would consent if he could be made to understand." "Take his feet, and I'll take his head," said Devine. "If you really think he's coming round," said Weston, "you'd better give him another dose. We can't start till we get the sunlight. It wouldn't be pleasant to have him struggling in there for 3 hours or so. It would be better if he didn't wake up till we were under way." "True enough. Just keep an eye on him while I run upstairs and get another." Devine left the room. Ransom saw through his half-closed eyes that Weston was standing over him. He had no means of foretelling how his own body would respond, if it responded at all, to a sudden attempt of movement, but he saw at once that he must take his chance. Almost before Devine had closed the door, he flung himself with all of his force at Weston's feet. The scientist fell forward across the chair, and Ransom, flinging him off with an agonizing effort, rose and dashed out into the hall. He was very weak and fell as he entered it, but terror was behind him, and in a couple of seconds he had found the hall door and was working desperately to master the bolts. Darkness and his trembling hands were against him. Before he had drawn one bolt, booted feet were clattering over the carpetless floor behind him. He was gripped by the shoulders and the knees. Kicking, writhing, dripping with sweat, and bellowing as loud as he could in the faint hope of rescue, he prolonged the struggle with a violence of which he would have believed himself incapable. For one glorious moment the door was open. The fresh night air was in his face. He saw the reassuring stars, and even his own pack lying on the porch. Then a heavy blow fell on his head. Consciousness faded, and the last thing of which he was aware was the grip of strong hands pulling him back into the dark passage, and the sound of a closing door. Chapter 3. When Ransom came to his senses, he seemed to be in bed in a dark room. He had a pretty severe headache, and this, combined with a general lassitude, discouraged him at first from attempting to rise or to take stock of his surroundings. He noticed, drawing his hand across his forehead, that he was sweating freely, and this directed his attention to the fact that the room, if it was a room, was remarkably warm. Moving his arms to fling off the bedclothes, he touched a wall at the right side of the bed. It was not only warm, but hot. He moved his left hand to and fro in the emptiness on the other side, and noticed that there the air was cooler. Apparently the heat was coming from the wall. He felt his face and found a bruise over the left eye. This recalled to his mind the struggle with Weston and Devine, and he instantly concluded that they had put him in an outhouse behind their furnace. At the same time, he looked up and recognized the source of the dim light in which, without noticing it, he had all along been able to see the movements of his own hands. There was some kind of skylight immediately over his head, a square of night sky filled with stars. It seemed to Ransom that he had never looked out on such a frosty night. Pulsing with brightness as with some unbearable pain or pleasure, clustered in pathless and countless multitudes, dreamlike in clarity, blazing in perfect blackness, the stars seized all his attention, troubled him, excited him, and drew him to a sitting position. At the same time, they quickened the throb of his headache, and this reminded him that he'd been drugged. He was just formulating to himself the theory that the stuff they had given him might have some effect on the pupil, and that this would explain the unnatural splendor and fullness of the sky, when a disturbance of silver light, almost a pale and miniature sunrise, at one corner of the skylight, drew his eyes upward again. Some minutes later, the orb of the full moon was pushing its way into the field of vision. Ransom sat still and watched. He had never seen such a moon, so white, so blinding, and so large. Like a great football just outside the glass, he thought. And then, a moment later, no, it's bigger than that. By this time he was quite certain that something was seriously wrong with his eyes. No moon could possibly be the size of the thing he was seeing. The light of the huge moon, if it was a moon, had by now illuminated his surroundings almost as clearly as if it were day. It was a very strange room. The floor was so small that the bed and the table beside it occupied the whole width of it. The ceiling seemed to be nearly twice as wide, and the walls sloped outward as they rose, so that Ransom had the impression of lying at the bottom of a deep and narrow wheelbarrow. This confirmed his belief that his sight was either temporarily or permanently injured. In other respects, however, he was recovering rapidly, and even beginning to feel an unnatural lightness of heart, and a not disagreeable excitement. The heat was still oppressive, and he stripped off everything but his shirt and trousers before rising to explore. His rising was disastrous, and raised graver apprehensions in his mind about the effects of being drugged. Although he had been conscious of no unusual muscular effort, he found himself leaping from the bed with an energy which brought his head into sharp contact with the skylight, and flung him down again in a heap on the floor. He found himself on the other side against the wall, a wall that ought to have sloped outwards like the side of a wheelbarrow, according to his previous reconnaissance, but it didn't. He felt it and looked at it. It was unmistakably at right angles to the floor. More cautiously this time, he rose again to his feet. He felt an extraordinary lightness of body, and it was with difficulty that he kept his feet on the floor. For the first time, a suspicion that he might be dead and already in the ghost life crossed his mind. He was trembling, but 100 mental habits forbade him to consider this possibility. Instead, he explored his prison. The result was beyond doubt. All the walls looked as if they sloped outwards, so as to make the room wider at the ceiling than it was at the floor. But each wall, as you stood beside it, turned out to be perfectly perpendicular, not only to sight, but to touch also. If one stooped down and examined with one's fingers the angle between it and the floor. The same examination revealed two other curious facts. The room was walled and floored with metal, and was in a state of continuous faint vibration, a silent vibration with a strangely lifelike and unmechanical quality about it. But if the vibration was silent, there was plenty of noise going on, a series of musical raps at quite irregular intervals which seemed to come from the ceiling. It was as if the metal chamber in which he found himself was being bombarded with small, tinkling missiles. Ransom was by now thoroughly frightened, not with the prosaic fright that a man suffers in a war, but with a heady, bounding kind of fear that was hardly distinguishable from his general excitement. He was poised on a sort of emotional watershed from which he felt he might at any moment pass either into delirious terror or into an ecstasy of joy. He knew now that he was not in a house, but in some moving vessel. It was clearly not a submarine, and the infinitesimal quivering of the metal did not suggest the motion of any wheeled vehicle. A ship, then, he supposed, or some kind of airship, but there was an oddity in all his sensations for which neither supposition accounted. Puzzled, he sat down again on the bed and stared at the portentous moon. An airship, some kind of flying machine. But why did the moon look so big? It was larger than he had thought at first. No moon could really be that size. And he realized now that he had known this from the first, but had repressed the knowledge through terror. At the same moment a thought came into his head which stopped his breath. There could be no full moon at all that night. He remembered distinctly that he had walked from Natterby in a moonless night. Even if the thin crescent of a new moon had escaped his notice, it could not have grown to this in a few hours. It could not have grown to this at all, this megalomaniac disk, far larger than the football he had at first compared it to, larger than a child's hoop, filling almost half the sky. And where was the old man in the moon, the familiar face that had looked down on all the generations of men? The thing wasn't the moon at all, and he felt his hair move on his scalp. At that moment the sound of an opening door made him turn his head. An oblong of dazzling light appeared behind him, and instantly vanished as the door closed again, having admitted the bulky form of a naked man whom Ransom recognized as Weston. No reproach, no demand for an explanation rose to Ransom's lips or even to his mind, not with that monstrous orb above them. The mere presence of a human being, with its offer of at least some companionship, broke down the tension in which his nerves had long been resisting a bottomless dismay. He found, when he spoke, that he was sobbing. "Weston! Weston!" he gasped. "What is it? It's not the moon, not that size. It can't be, can it?" "No," replied Weston. "It's the Earth." Chapter 4 Ransom's legs failed him, and he must have sunk back upon the bed, but he only became aware of this many minutes later. At the moment he was unconscious of everything except his fear. He did not even know what he was afraid of. The fear itself possessed his whole mind, a formless, infinite misgiving. He did not lose consciousness, though he greatly wished that he might do so. Any change, death or sleep, or best of all, a waking which would show all this for a dream, would have been inexpressibly welcome. None came. Instead, the lifelong self-control of social man, the virtues which are half hypocrisy, or the hypocrisy which is half a virtue, came back to him, and soon he found himself answering Weston in a voice not shamefully tremulous. "Do you mean that?" he asked.
"Certainly."
"Then where are we?"
"Standing out from Earth about 85,000 miles.
"You mean we're in space?"
Ransom uttered the word with difficulty, as a frightened child speaks of ghosts, or a frightened man of cancer. Weston nodded.
"What for?" said Ransom. "And what on earth have you kidnapped me for? And how have you done it?"
For a moment Weston seemed disposed to give no answer. Then, as if on a second thought, he sat down on the bed beside Ransom and spoke as follows. "I suppose it will save trouble if I deal with these questions at once, instead of leaving you to pester us with them every hour for the next month. As to how we do it, I suppose you mean how the spaceship works. There's no good your asking that. Unless you were one of the 4 or 5 real physicists now living, you couldn't understand. And if there were any chance of your understanding, you certainly wouldn't be told. If it makes you happy to repeat words that don't mean anything, which is in fact what unscientific people want when they ask for an explanation, you may say we work by exploiting the less observed properties of solar radiation. As to why we are here, we are on our way to Malacandra."
"Do you mean a star called Malacandra?"
"Even you can hardly suppose we are going out of the solar system. Malacandra is much nearer than that. We shall make it in about 28 days."
"There isn't a planet called Malacandra," objected Ransom.
"I'm giving it its real name, not the name invented by terrestrial astronomers," said Weston.
"But surely this is nonsense," said Ransom. "How the deuce did you find out its real name, as you call it?"
"From the inhabitants."
It took Ransom some time to digest this statement. "Do you mean to tell me you claim to have been to this star before, or this planet, or whatever it is?"
"Yes." "You can't really ask me to believe that," said Ransom. "Damn it all, it's not an everyday affair. Why has no one heard of it? Why has it not been in all the papers?"
"Because we're not perfect idiots," said Weston gruffly.
After a few moments' silence, Ransom began again. "Which planet is it in our terminology?" he asked.
"Once and for all," said Weston, "I'm not going to tell you. If you know how to find out when we get there, you're welcome to do so. I don't think we have much to fear from your scientific attainments. In the meantime, there's no reason for you to know."
"And you say this place is inhabited," said Ransom.
Weston gave him a peculiar look and then nodded. The uneasiness which this produced in Ransom rapidly merged in an anger which he had almost lost sight of amidst the conflicting emotions that beset him.
"And what has all this to do with me?" he broke out. "You have assaulted me, drugged me, and are apparently carrying me off as a prisoner in this infernal thing. What have I done to you? What do you say for yourself?"
"I might reply by asking you why you crept into my backyard like a thief. If you had minded your own business, you would not be here. As it is, I admit that we have had to infringe your rights. My only defense is that small claims must give way to great. As far as we know, we are doing what has never been done in the history of man, perhaps never in the history of the universe. We have learned how to jump off the speck of matter on which our species began. Infinity, and therefore perhaps eternity, is being put into the hands of the human race. You cannot be so small-minded as to think that the rights or the life of an individual or of a million individuals are of the slightest importance in comparison with this."
"I happen to disagree," said Ransom, "and I always have disagreed, even about vivisection. But you haven't answered my question. What do you want me for? What good am I to do you on this... on Malacandra?"
"That I don't know," said Weston. "It was no idea of ours. We are only obeying orders."
"Whose?"
There was another pause.
"Come," said Weston at last. "There is really no use in continuing this cross-examination. You keep on asking me questions I can't answer. In some cases, because I don't know the answers. In others, because you wouldn't understand them. It will make things very much pleasanter during the voyage if you can only resign your mind to your fate and stop bothering yourself and us. It would be easier if your philosophy of life were not so insufferably narrow and individualistic. I thought no one could fail to be inspired by the role you are being asked to play, that even a worm, if it could understand, would rise to the sacrifice. I mean, of course, the sacrifice of time and liberty and some little risk. Don't misunderstand me."
"Well," said Ransom, "you hold all the cards, and I must make the best of it. I consider your philosophy of life raving lunacy. I suppose all that stuff about infinity and eternity means that you think you are justified in doing anything, absolutely anything, here and now, on the off chance that some creatures or other descended from man as we know them may crawl about a few centuries longer in some part of the universe."
"Yes, anything whatever," returned the scientist sternly. "And all educated opinion, for I do not call classics and history and such trash education, is entirely on my side. I am glad you raised the point, and I advise you to remember my answer. In the meantime, if you follow me into the next room, we will have breakfast. Be careful how you get up. Your weight here is hardly appreciable compared to your weight on Earth."
Ransom rose, and his captor opened the door. Instantly the room was flooded with a dazzling golden light, which completely eclipsed the pale earthlight behind him.
"I will give you darkened glasses in a moment," said Weston, as he preceded him into the chamber whence the radiance was pouring.
It seemed to Ransom that Weston went up a hill towards the doorway, and then disappeared suddenly downwards when he had passed it. When he followed, which he did with caution, he had the curious impression that he was walking up to the edge of a precipice. The new room beyond the doorway seemed to be built on its side, so that its farther wall lay almost in the same plane as the floor of the room he was leaving. When, however, he ventured to put forward his foot, he found that the floor continued flush, and as he entered the second room, the walls suddenly righted themselves, and the rounded ceiling was over his head. Looking back, he perceived that the bedroom in its turn was now heeling over, its roof a wall, and one of its walls a roof.
"You will soon get used to it," said Weston, following his gaze. The ship is roughly spherical, and now that we are outside the gravitational field of the Earth, down means and feels towards the center of our own little metal world. This, of course, was foreseen, and we built her accordingly. The core of the ship is a hollow globe. We keep our stores inside it, and the surface of that globe is the floor we are walking on. The cabins are arranged all around this, their walls supporting an outer globe, which from our point of view is the roof. As the center is always down, the piece of floor you are standing on always feels flat or horizontal, and the wall you are standing against always seems vertical. On the other hand, the globe of the floor is so small that you can always see over the edge of it, over what would be the horizon if you were a flea, and then you can see the floors and wall of the next cabin in a different plane. It's just the same on Earth, of course, only we're not big enough to see it. After this explanation, he made arrangements in his precise, ungracious way for the comfort of his guest or prisoner. Ransom, at his advice, removed all his clothes and substituted a little metal girdle hung with enormous weights to reduce, as far as possible, the unmanageable lightness of his body. He also assumed tinted glasses and soon found himself seated opposite Weston at a small table laid for breakfast. He was both hungry and thirsty, and eagerly attacked the meal, which consisted of tinned meat, biscuit, butter, and coffee. But all of these actions he had performed mechanically. Stripping, eating, and drinking passed almost unnoticed, and all he ever remembered of his first meal in the spaceship was the tyranny of heat and light. Both were present in a degree which would have been intolerable on Earth, but each had a new quality. The light was paler than any light of comparable intensity that he had ever seen. It was not pure white, but the palest of all imaginable golds, and it cast shadows as sharp as a floodlight. The heat, utterly free from moisture, seemed to knead and stroke the skin like a gigantic masseur. It produced no tendency to drowsiness, rather intense alacrity. His headache was gone. He felt vigilant, courageous, and magnanimous, as he had seldom felt on Earth. Gradually, he dared to raise his eyes to the skylight. Steel shutters were drawn across all but a chink of the glass, and that chink was covered with blinds of some heavy and dark material, but still it was too bright to look at. "I always thought space was dark and cold," he remarked vaguely. "Forgotten the sun," said Weston contemptuously. Ransom went on eating for some time. Then he began, "If it's like this in the early morning," and stopped, warned by the expression on Weston's face. Awe fell upon him. There were no mornings here, no evenings, and no nights, nothing but the changeless noon which had filled for centuries beyond history so many millions of cubic miles. He glanced at Weston again, but the latter held up his hand. "Don't talk," he said. "We've discussed all that is necessary. The ship does not carry oxygen enough for any unnecessary exertion, not even for talking." Shortly afterwards he rose, without inviting the other to follow him, and left the room by one of the many doors which Ransom had not yet seen opened. Chapter 5. The period spent in the spaceship ought to have been one of terror and anxiety for Ransom. He was separated by an astronomical distance from every member of the human race except two whom he had excellent reasons for distrusting. He was heading for an unknown destination, and was being brought thither for a purpose which his captors steadily refused to disclose. Devine and Weston relieved each other regularly in a room which Ransom was never allowed to enter, and where he supposed the controls of their machine must be. Weston, during his watches off, was almost entirely silent. Devine was more loquacious, and would often talk and guffaw with the prisoner until Weston rapped on the wall of the control room and warned them not to waste air. But Devine was secretive after a certain point. He was quite ready to laugh at Weston's solemn scientific idealism. He didn't give a damn, he said, for the future of the species or the meeting of two worlds. "There's more to Malacandra than that," he would add with a wink. But when Ransom asked him what more, he would lapse into satire and make ironical remarks about the white man's burden and the blessings of civilization. "It is inhabited, then," Ransom would press. "Ah! There's always a native question in these things," Devine would answer. For the most part, his conversation ran on the things he would do when he got back to Earth. Ocean-going yachts, the most expensive women, and a big place on the Riviera figured largely in his plans. "I'm not running all these risks for fun." Direct questions about Ransom's own role were usually met with silence. Only once, in reply to such a question, Divine, who was then in Ransom's opinion very far from sober, admitted they were rather handing him the baby. "But I'm sure," he added, "you'll live up to the old school tie." All this, as I have said, was sufficiently disquieting. The odd thing was that it did not very greatly disquiet him. It is hard for a man to brood on the future when he is feeling so extremely well as Ransom now felt. There was an endless night on one side of the ship, and an endless day on the other. Each was marvelous, and he moved from one to the other at his will, delighted. In the nights which he could create by turning the handle of a door, he lay for hours in contemplation of the skylight. The Earth's disk was nowhere to be seen. The stars, thick as daisies on an uncut lawn, reigned perpetually, with no cloud, no moon, no sunrise to dispute their sway. There were planets of unbelievable majesty, and constellations undreamed of. There were celestial sapphires, rubies, emeralds, and pinpricks of burning gold. Far out on the left of the picture hung a comet, tiny and remote. And between all and behind all, far more emphatic and palpable than it showed on Earth, the undimensioned, enigmatic blackness. The lights trembled. They seemed to grow brighter as he looked. Stretched naked on his bed, a second Danae, he found it night by night more difficult to disbelieve in old astrology. Almost he felt, wholly he imagined, sweet influence pouring or even stabbing into his surrendered body. All was silence but for the irregular tinkling noises. He knew now that these were made by meteorites, small drifting particles of the world stuff that smote continually on their hollow drum of steel. And he guessed that at any moment they might meet something large enough to make meteorites of ship and all. But he could not fear. He now felt that Weston had justly called him little-minded in the moment of his first panic. The adventure was too high, its circumstance too solemn for any emotion save a severe delight. But the days, that is, the hours spent in the sunward hemisphere of their microcosm, were the best of all. Often he rose after only a few hours' sleep to return, drawn by an irresistible attraction, to the regions of light. He could not cease to wonder at the noon which always awaited you, however early you went to seek it. There, totally immersed in a bath of pure ethereal color and of unrelenting, though unwounding, brightness, stretched his full length, and with eyes half closed in the strange chariot that bore them, faintly quivering through depth after depth of tranquility far above the reach of night, he felt his body and mind daily rubbed and scoured and filled with new vitality. Weston, in one of his brief, reluctant answers, admitted a scientific basis for these sensations. They were receiving, he said, many rays that never penetrated the terrestrial atmosphere. This book is continued on cassette number 2, side 1.